I don't even know if it's recording, but let's assume that it is. Okay. So I'm talking to James Greenberg and his and about his new really, really well put together and quite well written book, Roman Polanski, A Retrospective, which is I didn't realize when you first told me about it, James, that it's really one of those books you can kind of lose yourself in because of the size and the great wealth of stills, which are from his entire career and his personal history, which are quite extravagant and informative and unique. I haven't seen a lot of these photos, most of them, I should say.
I got a Polanski was kind enough to let me go through his personal archives, and I spent a sweltering week last summer in August when I was in Paris going through his closet, literally going through old family photos and baby pictures of God knows who. Mm-hmm. So it was a really kind of an extraordinary experience to do that. The there was one shot that I was particularly happy with that I hadn't seen before. It was a contact sheet of him directing Sharon Tate on Fearless Vampire Killers. Huh. And I thought that was really, that kind of took my breath away to see him, you know, these two people alive at work.
Did he allow you, did he give you actual hard prints from his personal archives and allow you to scan them and then return them? Is that how it worked?
I did. I went through them and did some selects, and then I passed it on to the photo editor for the book, and I believe they did some scans for the photo editor, some high-res images. So I believe it went that way. I was really took it as far as the selection.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that I think that just to jump into one of my favorite Polanski films, which is 1971's Macbeth. I think particularly since the advent of the Tarantino vogue of ironic violence, violence as fashion, that violence as style. Violence as something to wear and to flaunt for almost cartoonish amusement with no particular echo or connection to what it feels like to be a recipient of or even an observer of actual real-life violence, which is pretty horrific. And Polanski's perspective is that he was privy to the most horrific fears and nightmares and threats of violence as a child during the occupation.
Exactly.
And he understands and respects the horror of it. And I love this quote that he gave to you for Macbeth, which is that you have to show violence the way it is. If you don't show it realistically, that's immoral and harmful. If you don't upset people, that's obscenity. I think what he meant was that's obscene or that's an obscenity, but you're quoting him directly. But I completely agree with that. I don't know of too many people who feel that way who are making films today. Very few. Because
No, I couldn't agree with you more, and especially on both counts. And I think Macbeth is really one of his great films that's perhaps one of the most overlooked. It's really a terrific movie, and in terms of the violence, he said it's a violent play. And you know, when it came out, he was accused of this was a commentary on the Sharon Tate murder, the whole Manson thing, and because it was the first film he did after that. And he said that you know, he considered what to do next, and he said he thought it would be obscene to do a comedy or to do something light. So he said, you know, Shakespeare should be fine, and he'd wanted to do Shakespeare for a long time. He'd been captivated with it since he saw the Laurence Olivier Hamlet when he was in film school. Oh, actually, it was before when he was a kid. Mm. But so he had wanted to do a Shakespeare, and Macbeth hadn't been done a lot, and you know, to be true to the play, it had to have that level of violence and that immediacy. And he's not somebody who uses violence gratuitously. It's there for a reason.
Right.
And you know, in the case of Macbeth, it's, I think it means something. It's very, very effective. And yes, I agree with you. It's not ironic. It's not ha-ha violence. It's earned violence, if you will.
Mm-hmm. He's, I was wondering what you were getting from him as far as his favorite children, if you were. I think that as we get older, we tend to process things and feel more kinship with certain creations mm-hmm. than others. What was your sense of his particular, of how strong his ardor was for this or that film? What did you feel were his favorite children, or are his favorite children at this stage?
That's a good point, because one of the things I write about in the Chinatown chapter is I was having a conversation with him some years ago, and he was giving me a ride back to Paris from the studio after shooting, and I started gushing about Chinatown, and you know, he kind of looked at me and said, "Ah, it's not so good." I can't even take his accent, but it's not so good. And I was flabbergasted, and years later, what I realized was Chinatown didn't need his affection, it didn't need his support, because it was generally regarded universally as a masterpiece. So he kind of reserved that for, you know, the stepchildren, as it were. And I think probably the one that's really close to his heart is Fearless Vampire Killers. It's where he started his relationship with Sharon Tate. They shot it up in the Italian Alps, and he's a skiing fanatic, and there's you know, a lot of snow, a lot of skiing in the movie, and it, mm-hmm. and he appreciates the humor of it. I think that film just tickles him, and I think that that's really one of his personal favorites. I think he likes Cul-de-Sac quite a bit. He thinks that that's a real film in the sense that it couldn't be done as anything else. It couldn't be a play. It couldn't be a novel. It couldn't be a story. It's really cinematic. And it's a story that you couldn't tell any other way. Mm-hmm. So I think he feels that that was his vision, and Gerard Brock, who he wrote it with, his frequent collaborator,
right.
that they really got on screen what they had in their twisted minds.
I was kind of wondering what your personal opinion, did you, I know that you, well, I don't know, but I'm presuming that the bulk of your conversation with Polanski was over what, during 11 and the earlier part of 12 or something? When exactly did your conversations take place?
Well, they were over a course of about 20 years. I first met him, I think, in 1991. I was invited with a handful of journalists to watch him shoot for a week on Forbidden Moon,
mm-hmm.
and it was on a second-rate Greek cruise ship going from mm-hmm. Venice to Athens.
Mm-hmm.
They were shooting the exteriors for Bitter Moon,
mm-hmm.
so that's the first time I met him. And then I interviewed him on the boat. I interviewed him back in Paris, and then I came back and interviewed him again. And then a couple of years later after that, and then I did a larger story in about another large story in, I think it was about 2008, mm-hmm. and then I interviewed him again in Paris last summer, so that would have been 2012.
And he shot Venus and Fur at the time when you spoke to him in Paris last summer?
I'm sorry?
Had he shot his most recent film, Venus and Fur?
Venus and Fur. No, it wasn't even on the radar. I had a subsequent phone conversation with him on that. When I saw him last summer, he was trying to get the Dreyfus Affair, D, off the ground. And that was looked like his next project. And then all of a sudden, he was trying to get the script ready, and this opportunity for Venus and Fur came up, and he just jumped on it and did a very fast shoot. And I think he was pleased that he would do two pictures one after the other, assuming that he does pick up with Dreyfus after this.
So that's in your opinion, that he is on the road to the Dreyfus film, and probably that will come to pass?
Well, it's a period piece, and it's a larger film, and it's kind of an international film.
Right.
So, like all of these projects, I think it's not easy to raise money for.
Mm-hmm.
He's always positive about his next project, so, I'm not privy to his finances, so I don't really know how much of the money they have or whether they're ready to go or not. I believe he's still working on the script with Harris, who did the ghostwriting. Is it Richard Harris, Robert Harris?
Is that the same Robert Harris who's the author, or different? I keep getting the Harrises.
No, the same one. The same one who did the ghostwriter.
Okay.
And the novelist.
Right. Okay.
So that he's doing the Dreyfus script with him.
I was pretty damn happy with the ghostwriter. I got to say, I thought that was that's right up there among the top of the list. Also, I was really pretty. I kind of suspected when I first saw it that it was going to be a sufficiently good but not especially good film, and I, mm-hmm. I've since seen it like three times now. It's really quite everybody hits the notes just right. So.
Yeah, I agree. Getting to do this book, one of the treats of doing it was being able to watch all of the movies multiple times over again, and then in some cases talk to him about it, and. Ghostwriter was one that really grew on me,
mm-hmm.
and it has that real Polanski creepiness,
mm-hmm.
the real sense of impending doom that something's going to happen, and that Rosemary's Baby has right from the first frame.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've asked him many times, Roman, how do you do this?
Mm-hmm.
And he shrugs his shoulders, I don't know. And there was one scene in Ghost Rider that I asked him about that was its vividness was so strong for me, where the Ian McEwan character is in the house and he's looking out on the porch, and it's gray day and the porch is gray and everything is gray and it's raining. And there's a gardener sweeping the porch, and the emptiness, and I think at the same time the emotion in the frame was just so powerful, and it's hard to describe. And when I asked him about it, he couldn't describe it either. It's just he has an innate sense for creating these. Moments. It's really kind of uncanny how he does it.
The two creepiest moments that have always stayed with me in Rosemary's Baby, I have the Criterion Blu-ray, is the number one, that brief insert shot at the very beginning where Mia Farrow looks at the diary of the woman who is the horticulturalist who has recently passed. She has an herbal garden of sorts, or herbal greenhouse in her apartment, and she comes upon a note that says, "I can no longer associate myself." Right there, that tells, that's like a novel's worth of implication in that line right there, and that is that is a genuinely creepy moment. And it's funny, some people will look at it and they'll just kind of go, what, I don't care, you know, and others get what I'm talking about. That's really and there's also that moment
I think you get the foreboding there, and I think that's what's so great about Rosemary's Baby is just the sense of menace that's right there from the start. Even the opening credits, it's an aerial shot of the Dakota, but it's askance, and you just get from the credits, there's the credits, and then there's
James
Pharaoh humming that haunting theme underneath the credits, and then you see the Dakota sort of turns on its ass and turns sideways, and you immediately get the sense something is not right here, and indeed it's not. But Rosemary's Baby to me is like a perfect movie. There's not a false frame in it. There's not a bad shot. It's all purposeful, and it's there's some just beautiful stuff in there. It's really a pretty amazing film, and I've seen that one a lot, and it still continues to creep me out.
Nobody that I can think of has ever conveyed a dream or nightmare sequence. Anybody who does that, they always have the close-up of the person sleeping, and then they will fade into or do a quick cut to an image that is obviously happening in the person's dream, person's head. But nobody that I can think of has ever shown the person lying there and then waking up and looking up, and then you go up from the bed and there's all this stuff happening in the same frame without a cut.
Oh, yeah, that moment where she wakes up and this is not a dream.
I mean, is that
scary or what?
That mixture of Ruth Gordon's admonishing voice saying, I told you that she wouldn't be open-minded, and then you see guys building, laying bricks in the room. It's very, very weird the way he blends everything and lets it kind of run together, which is how foreboding daydreams and nightmares tend to feel. You know, you're dreaming them, and yet there's a reality to dreams that's really quite. And I thought he captured a feeling in that thing. There's also that. Go ahead.
He commented on that. I asked him about the dream sequence, and it's something I wrote about in the book. But what I recall is him saying he wanted to make it the way dreams really are, the way we really experience dreams, like you were saying, that not the way you see it in movies, not a cinematic dream, but the disjointedness that you feel when you have a dream, that one person can become another person, can become another sad thing, and it's all just fluid, and that's what he wanted to get. He wanted that real sense of realism.
You know, I was at Studio Babelsberg outside of Munich a couple of months ago, and they were telling me that the European street, the outdoor set that he used for, I forget, was it the train station depot where everybody's inside a pen, but there was certainly, he made good use of that set. It's a fairly large set, and I worship that film, but that whole outdoor Studio Babelsberg European set is going. It's been trashed. They've let it go for condo development.
Terrible.
Just the way MGM had to let their back lot go way back when, and that became a condo development. It's really sad.
Yeah, no, terrible. There's probably been a lot of films that have been shot there. There's a lot of film history that just sort of goes up in smoke.
Yeah. I was just wondering if you, I kind of admire Polanski's determination not to get on the phone with anybody at all ever during the lead up to the pianist being judged or you know, and possibly winning Oscars that year, which was what year was that? Was that 04, 02? What year was that? I can't remember.
The pianist was
03 or 04, as I recall, something like
02.
That.
02.
Okay.
It was released in 02, so it probably got the award in 03.
He just didn't do it, and there were a lot of haters at the time, at least the people who were commenting on the column I was doing for Real.com. The haters are a pretty strong bunch, and I thought perhaps, usually when there's a strong hate in the Hollywood community, that will somehow mitigate or lessen the ardor for those who admire and respect an artist for his or her own reasons. So I thought probably that film was going to be relegated to the also-ran. And I sure as hell didn't see Polanski winning Best Director. I fell off my chair when that happened. I literally fell off my chair. And I was so proud of Hollywood.
He told me about...
Huh?
I'm sorry. He was talking about... I asked him about that experience, and he said, you know, he was watching the show, and then... Right before that, I don't know if it was the award or a couple of awards before that, Ronald Harwood won for the script, and then Polanski said that he thought to himself, well, we have a chance, and Brody had already won, so Polanski's thinking, we have a chance, you know, and then, you know, of course, he was floored and delighted about it, it was a great treat, and... I think he probably didn't expect it either.
Did you ask him? I can't profess not to have read the pianist chapter, but I think that I've heard him say, and he probably repeated to you, that he couldn't quite go back to his childhood and to Nazi horrors until that point in his life. It's just you need perspective, you need decades. You know, there's a point in which, in any artist's life, in which they are finally able to render a certain subject in a way that is befitting the importance of it.
I think that's true. I think we talked about how he was glad that he hadn't made it earlier in his life, that he wouldn't have had the maturity or the even the vision or the filmmaking skills to execute it. So, and he had been offered. Spielberg had offered him Schindler's List years earlier, and he turned that down for other reasons too. That was Schindler's List was too close to home. It was the Krakow ghetto, and I mean that's straight biography. And that was too much for him. But I think also you're right in saying that he was not ready to do it. Mm-hmm. I think over the years he's gotten, you know, a lot of Holocaust projects have crossed his desk, and he just wasn't ready for it. And then he found this memoir, and he knew, you know, this kind of material just doesn't come along, and the timing was right, and it just all came together. He had met Spielman, ironically enough. I think when he was living in Los Angeles, Spielman had come through on some kind of Polish State Department tour, and he had met him briefly, just as a footnote to it all.
You know, one of the only real head scratchers of the last 10 years was I was kind of wondering why he had an interest in doing a Pompeii movie. That I couldn't understand. It just seemed like not really in his backyard. It seemed like something that would be necessarily effects driven for a good part of it. How could it not feel in some ways like a classic disaster film, you know, little sketches of say 10 or 15 mm-hmm. or 12 characters, and then they all react to the disaster in some way. I said, where is the Polanski element in something like this? Did you guys discuss it at all or get into
No, it didn't come up. We didn't talk about it. He's not a person who really looks back at things that didn't work, and there's so many projects that there was another project, I forget the name of it, by a Bulgarian writer or a Russian writer.
Yeah.
That he was doing with Warner Brothers, and he was quite far along, and that he was really pissed about that. But you know, he just kind of lets it go. I think with the Pompeii thing, he was doing that with Robert Harris as well, and so I think they would have found a human story as a way in. And he is fond of the broad historical canvas. He's very well read,
right.
And he likes very much what he can do with special effects now.
Right.
He thinks whatever you have in your mind, you can do, and it looks great. And he kind of laments not being able to do that in his earlier films in Repulsion. And he said, "Oh, it would have been so easy to do it." So he really does like technology at his disposal and using the special effects. So I think that the challenge of that was probably a good part of why he was attracted to that project.
You know, I had a person respond to me when I went on this big thing, because I saw Rosemary's Baby unmatted on television, I don't know, two or three times, and I also saw it in a Paris movie theater in, I forget, it was, might have been my first trip to Paris, 76 or something, or possibly when I was married there in 87, but I saw it there, and as you know, they tend to, their preferred aspect ratio is 1.66 over there, or at least it has been for many. And I saw it with a slightly higher, and I became locked into this idea that I loved the composition of that of Rosemary's Baby. And anyway, so I said it should be 1.66, even though I think that Polanski is wrong to say 1.88. And this guy who sounded a lot like Roman, whose email is Ignatz, Ignatz, he said, I'm very amused by your adamant belief that you know what the proper aspect ratio is, but my friends at Criterion and I have absolutely decided, and this is my wish, to have it at 1.85. I mean, it's very clear. And if it wasn't him, it was somebody who was doing an excellent imitation of what he probably, I don't know if you're aware that he somebody wrote, and people like A.O. Scott and others were saying, that sounds like him, you know. But
I recall that exchange, and it did, you know, it did seem like the real thing.
Yeah.
But,
I love speaking of Blu-rays, I love that how great the Repulsion looks. It looks so much like film. It's one of my favorite of his, and I pretty much all of them. The only thing that he didn't actually get into the quality issues on Chinatown, because you know some people say that doesn't look as good as it should. It looks, it's really like it's the DVD master. But they Blu-ray did a Blu-ray version of it. In other words, they didn't really go back to the elements and really get it right. And I know that he's enough of a tech head to appreciate what they're saying.
Yeah, no, that's not something we talked about. We didn't talk about the qualities of the film.
Right.
When I was there, he was doing the commentary for Rosemary's Baby for the Criterion. And he was trying to go on vacation, and they kept asking him to do more stuff, and he was getting annoyed. Getting annoyed about that. But his desire to see have things shown in the in good prints and in good quality. We didn't really talk about particular Blu-rays.
Uh-huh, okay. Well, I think I want to just compliment the. I'm not clear exactly who. I mean, Abrams is your publisher. They're based in New York. They're in West Village, Chelsea area, respected folks. But it says that the book was created and produced by Palazzo Editions in London. So who's the quality of the paper, the superb stills, the just generally classy, superb rendering all the way through. So who is the primary responsible party as far as what did Palazzo do?
Palazzo put the project together, and Palazzo brought me into the project.
And what year did they actually say, James, could you maybe put a book together? What year did that happen? What year did they actually contact you and say, we think you'd be a great guy to do a book on Roman, would you like to do it, and could we talk specifics? What year did that happen?
It wasn't that long ago. It was about two and a half years ago.
Oh, okay. So
it happened fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. They knew I had done extensive interviews with him over the years, and so I think that was the main reason they approached me.
Mm-hmm.
And then they work in conjunction with Abrams. Abrams has all of the English speaking rights, and including the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And the book's being published simultaneously in England, mm-hmm. and Spain and Germany, and it's coming out at the end of September in France, because August doesn't exist on the French calendar.
Oh yeah, of course.
I mean, the reason it's coming out, and we should mention this, is that it's Polanski's 80th birthday on August 18th.
Okay.
And that's that's the occasion for the book,
mm-hmm.
and why it's coming out in the midst of the summer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So to coincide with his birthday.
When I was there in Paris. I've met him. I've run into him twice. I met him at Nice Airport about 6 years ago. He just happened to be there, waiting for his wife to show up. He said hello and everything. He also called me. He was nice enough to call me way back in the end of 01, going into 02, when I was in Paris looking to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little phoner. And he said, he's calling me at my little Paris apartment. He said, I hear you're in town. I know you want to talk to me. I hear you're a nice guy, but I'm not going to talk to you.
Yeah.
I said, well, thanks for calling me and telling me that.
Yeah, well.
No, I meant that.
He's great.
It's nice when
he's gracious,
call
if nothing
you.
Else.
Yeah.
he has Jack Nicholson once described him to me as that the perception of Roman was not really as he knew him, that he saw him as really kind of an old school, an old world gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And right. I'm sure many would bristle at that description, but in terms of my dealings with him, he's always been very courteous and responsive and charming, and when he says he's going to do something, he does it.
Right.
So, you can't expect much more from a subject.
Can I ask, as part of your immersion into the realm of Polanski, did you ever go up to 10,050 Cielo Drive?
No, I didn't go up there. I didn't go up there. I know that it's been destroyed.
I was so shocked. I happened to drive up there in a scooter about a year ago, maybe. I didn't know. I know that Trent Reznor had lived there in the 90s, and I thought...
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he was told by a relation of Sharon's, why are you living in that house? Are you trying to somehow exploit my sister's tragedy or something? And he said, no, I didn't really thought about that, but then he kind of felt badly about, because he's a famous guy and he's living in that house. And I went up there anyway, and I was shocked thrown back almost, really, by, not only had they destroyed it and torn it down, but some record, I think it's a record producer, or is it a TV guy, had built this Mediterranean nouveau riche monstrosity.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something, mm-hmm. I mean, not to get off on a pointless side issue, but Cielo, the house that he had there had been built back in the 1940s, and it had a wonderful kind of a Western ranch house feeling with nice trees, and it was just a beautiful place. I thought it was very, very sad that
on the title page of the book.
Yeah.
There's a shot of Polanski coming down from a spiral staircase.
Oh, I love that shot. Yeah, that's nice.
And it's identified as Polanski at home in Los Angeles in 1969. And I hadn't really picked up on that, but that could very well be the house.
Okay. Could be.
And I didn't put two and two together.
Yeah, yeah.
So it seems like it must be.
Mm-hmm.
If the caption is correct.
Right. All right, man. This has been great. Is the actual publishing date in the U.S. Happened, or is it about to happen? What's the actual?
Well, it's in Book Soup. Book Soup has them already.
Okay good.
I don't know if anyone else has them, but I know they're there, and the actual pub date is the 6th. That's when Amazon says that they're going to mail it, but as I said, that's Tuesday.
So sometimes Book Soup will go a little bit early, a little earlier than the publishing date, but... Okay, that's good.
I'm going to do a signing at Book Soup on the 13th of August. And then the Cinematheque's doing three nights of Polanski films on the 16th through the 18th.
All right. Is it the one on Hollywood Boulevard, of course?
Egyptian Theater, yeah.
Okay.
I'll be there on the 18th, and they're doing a great double feature, Repulsion and Rosemary's Baby,
mm-hmm.
and that happens to be Polanski's birthday. So that's kind of a nice day.
So you are going to be interviewed that particular day. Is that what you're saying?
I'm going to introduce the films and be there to sign the book.
Okay, excellent. All right, well, I'll bring my copy by at either Book Soup or that event and ask for a signature.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. A pleasure to talk to a knowledgeable person about Polanski, and I think I mentioned how much I enjoy your site. It's really my favorite.
Oh, good, man. Thank you. All right, let's have a good Saturday, and I'll put this up probably later today.
Okay, great. Talk to you.
You will.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.